Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We have a lot to talk about this hour, we're going to really focus on roots. I don't know how many of you saw the opening episode last night. Been a lot of buzz about it. We watched it at home. I missed a basketball game to watch it, but I watched it because I wanted to see it. And also we were thinking, reflecting back on 40 years ago, when the first Roots came out and the effect that had on the society. And there's been a lot of arguments that I've seen that my dear friend Jared Ball and I have been going back and forth on Facebook about how important or not important Roots is. And he has his interesting analysis that I'll bring up in the part of this conversation. But the profound effect some people think it had 40 years ago, beginning to change the nature of how we think of the American narrative, which was controlled by Gone with the Wind and Birth of a Nation, and beginning to open that up. And did that really happen? What does all that mean? Well, let me introduce our guest so we can jump right into it. He's a PhD now, Dr. David Zurwick, who is a Sun's media critic and assistant professor in the Department of Communications and Media Studies at Goucher College, who I go back a long way with on radio. Good to have you back, Dave.
I enjoy it. The theme song brought back memories. It's one of my favorite songs. I love that song.
There we go. Carla Wills joins us, senior news producer at Democracy Now!, always with a lot of interesting thoughts of her own as well. Carla, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Mark.
And Dr. Melissa Spence joins us also by Skype, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book, Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. Of course, he wrote Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. And Lester, good to have you here.
Hey, it's good to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number to call in. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can also send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. Log on to the Facebook pages. I'll check those out in a moment as well. But do call in, 410-319-8888. So I assume everybody here at this table saw. Well, I know you get them in advance.
Yes, I saw them all 8 hours.
It's all 8 hours. And so Lester and Carla, I assume you saw them last night.
I saw it this morning. That's my priority straight up the game last night.
I got you. I watched the end of the game last night. It was a great series.
It was a great series, but I saw it last night.
Okay, yeah. So, but let's go back a bit to 1976, 77, right?
77. It debuted in 77. The novel appeared in 76.
Okay. Yeah. So I remember that very well. When it came out, we actually bought our first color television because Roots came out. We wanted to watch it in color. I remember that. And then the entire group of people, like 20 people, gathered in our living room because nobody had color TV. We were the first one in our crew to have a color television. Everybody came over and watched it together as a family. Kids watched it. Everybody gathered around to watch this thing, Roots, after most of us had read the book the year before. So But some people say we're making too much of the profound impact and effect that original series had. Let me just start there. David, let me let you start and go around the room.
Well, you know, I was covering pop culture for the Detroit Free Press in 1977 when it came out. And probably one of the most important results of this is, and my wife was the television critic at the Free Press, and for about four or five years, programmers at the three networks, and it was a three-network universe primarily then, ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS was, you know, Lyndon Johnson sort of was just starting. It didn't have the strength that it does now, but or now it's in a little bit of a decline, but that it had at its peak. And network programmers, network executives, people at the level of executive vice presidents in charge of programming, would say to critics like us and reporters like us, we'd say, well, why aren't there more programs featuring characters, persons of color, either as actors or characters, people of color? And they'd say, we can't do it. White audiences will not watch shows with black stars and black actors in the lead. Now, as you know from my book, they also said that about Jews, and these were Jews saying it. The Jewish programmers were saying it about Jews. Network television was crazy because they catered so much to Madison Avenue, and they let Madison Avenue tell them how to do. So one of the most important results, I think, of the success of Roots in 1977 is that it told the public what a lie the networks had been promulgating in saying they couldn't put on shows with black characters in the lead. This blew that out of the water. And that made a difference. That made a difference in a real level way in terms of the kinds of programs that came on television. In the industry of Hollywood, in the kinds of shows that got funded for an initial script that were put, then made, got a pilot and then put into production. So you did see that increase afterwards, and I think that's important. Now, you got a lot of bad shows, too, as you always do with commercial television. You get a lot of bad shows with persons of color in the league, but you also got some good ones. That's one big change. I think the other change, anytime you get a show, and it could be for better or worse, but when 80 million people, as was the audience for that last night of Roots, the eighth night, sit down and watch something, and in those days watch it in the same time frame, I think that's, you know, we over-romanticize the shared experience of television in the old days because each of us watches it from our own social location. So it's a quasi-shared or mediated shared experience. But that's a powerful statement, and it did then generate a discussion about race. I don't know how informed that discussion was, you know. I came back, you know, 39 or 40 years later now and looked at this version, and my major reaction, my initial reaction was not so much about the series but about me. I thought, man, you know, when I watched that in 77, I didn't realize that Alex Haley. The author, had flipped the captivity narrative on its head. I mean, one of the earliest ways that European and white culture taught racism was with the captivity narrative in colonial America. European white settlers being captured by Native Americans, horrible things being done to them by these quote-unquote savages. This story says, no, you know who the savages were? I'll show you. It's the slave traders. It's the white plantation owners. That's savage behavior, and persons of color are the victims of that. That, to me, is a powerful. You're taking one of the most fundamental racist narratives of American life, and you're trying to deal with it. I don't know how different people read it, what different meaning they make out of it. That's why we have arguments about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. But in terms of Alex Haley doing that in the script, I didn't appreciate it. I missed that in 77. This time around, I saw it immediately, and it grabbed me.
So Carla, can you reflect back on that moment, and then before we turn to Lester?
In 77? Yeah. You know what was interesting, and I only read this. I'm getting terrible feedback.
Is a lot. Maybe you should try phone.
Yeah, exactly. I only read this recently because of the remake coming out now. When I read the book after seeing the actual series, because I was much, much younger, but I read the book, I think maybe I was in high school by the time I read the book. But when it first came out, you know, of course, we all were in our living rooms watching it, and it was, you know, that where the whole family watches it, and then you try to figure out how you deal with all this new information when you go to school the next day. But one of the things I read recently because of the remake is that David Wolper, who was the producer of this series, you know, the original Roots, did a real masterful thing in casting the slave owners, the masters, the slave traders, in the original series. One of the things that was really striking about it is that he cast the folks who were, you know, like heroes or your favorite, you know, fathers in series, like Robert Reed from the Brady Bunch or Lauren Green, or, you know, those folks who weren't bad guys. They weren't bad guys in our, you know, in television or movies or anything. They were good guys, but they put them in these positions to be these, you know, slave masters who did horrendous things to folks. And that made everyone get, like David was talking about turning something on his head. That's something else that turned it on his head. It just showed how everyone was complicit in this atrocity. So it wasn't that there were, you know, the good white guys and the bad white guys. Every person who was a part of this, of slavery and the slave trade, they were complicit in one of the most horrendous experiences in the country. And so that was something else that struck me now looking back at it.
And Lester?
Yeah, it's important for folk who may not, you know, who may be younger than all the people on the show. More people watch Roots, I believe, than any other thing that had appeared like it on television. So to reiterate that, really, there are a whole set of narratives about what black people would and what white people would and wouldn't watch. I mean, so I began talking about the fact that I watched the game. It's important to note that the National Basketball Association Finals of 1979 was preempted. So you wouldn't watch the game in real time. You watch the game like 3-4 hours after, because people felt that white people really wouldn't want to watch basketball players. So what Roots did was begin to kill kind of a myth that still existed like 3-4 years later in basketball and other similar in other programming. But secondarily, secondly, on the flip side of that, I was out living outside of Detroit when the film appeared. And we were just, the city of Detroit was just 4 years into being black run, you know, into the Coleman Young's first mayoral term was just about to end in 1977. So this was a period of nascent black political power, and what Roots represented was that nascent black political power being transformed into a certain cultural power, right? To wit, that there were still scholars at that time that were arguing that slavery was actually a beneficial thing and that black people actually benefited from slavery and that they were dragged into civilization, right? What that did was change the cultural narrative almost overnight, where it's really difficult to make that argument after watching Roots. And then finally, the title of it, and I know some people have questions about this, or there's probably argument about this. I believe the title of Roots is Roots in American Family, right? That whole concept, while at the same time, it's important to note that the African-American experience is different. What Alex Haley does by centering the American, by having the American without the hyphen, is actually suggesting what he does with that with Roots is he's stating that what America is begins with the black black families. What happens with black families as they're taken from Africa? That actually is the primary immigrant narrative that makes America what it was, not the narrative of European settlers coming over and making their way.
Those are really important points to make here.
Wow, yeah.
Very powerful points to make. And yeah. I think that, you know, one of the things, and I'll come back to some of these, one of the things that struck me about watching last night's piece, which was different than what I remember watching back in the 70s, and I think I've watched it one other time since. I was trying to watch it this week, but I never got around to watching the past episodes like as I wanted to. However, was that the depiction in this Roots, new Roots, of the Mandinka Society, of what was happening in that territory as an urban center, and especially when the son was talking about, no, I want to go to Timbuktu to do all this other kind of learning, which had those pieces in this set up a much different narrative about the power and depth of various African cultures, focusing on the Mandinka, obviously. But I thought that was something, Carla, that struck me was very different.
Very different. And that was the first thing that struck me as different. And I remember before it came on, I was saying what I really appreciated about the first Roots is that they did spend a lot of time in Jufure and setting up, just showing the beauty, the culture, you know, the humanity of the people, how powerful their connections were, all of that. And I hope that this new one will do the same. Well, what I think changed a little bit is maybe they didn't spend quite as much time there, but they set it up in this context. I mean, the first words of Lawrence Fishburne in the series is when he talks about this great village of Jufure on the banks of the Gambie Bolongo being, you know, and that they traded slaves like
other, you know, great civilizations like the Greeks and the Romans, they also traded slaves. And so he set it all up that way. So you're already thinking, okay, we're talking about an advanced, you know, culture, civilization and people. And then, you know, like you said, you know, and after Kunta Kinte goes through his celebration of manhood, you know, how he wants to go to, you know, the university in Timbuktu and, you know, the whole, I mean, it was like, wow, he's really establishing, they're really establishing that this is a great, you know, civilization and that, you know, that this is where it all started before anyone arrives here on these shores. So that was powerful.
It was. And I think the organized society part of it was really powerful, especially if you understand the history, which they didn't get into, just the history of the reality that the majority of slave revolts in the Western Hemisphere were led by people who were Muslims and enslaved because they came from organized society and organized things in a certain way that allowed them to lead the rebellions in a fashion, almost like a warlike fashion, that didn't happen with others. Because they didn't say that in this thing. But knowing the history, I mean, I could feel there was a different turning here that I thought was really important. I'm curious what to do with the rest of it. But what were you thinking, David, before we turn back to Lester?
No, I absolutely was. I was very impressed with that opening. I was also impressed with something about that. There's an interest in Kunta Kinte in doing the things, it's exactly what was just said about wanting to go to the university and his parents wanting them to go into warfare, essentially. But it's also in culture how you have to get the young men and the young women now. You have to get them to believe enough in your culture to go and fight for it to make the culture survive. And in a way, you see that threat from the outside that they face. But it is, you know, this is the other thing that seems so brilliant about this overall narrative, is you do have this hero quest. Kunta Kinte is, in a way, the hero on this. And you have to leave a place and go off into these battles in that journey. And the Jufre is so idyllic and so righteous compared to what's going on in America. You know, he sees this young woman. He's also at an age where they're thinking about marriage and things like that. And their relationship seems so sort of, and it's just budding. You don't really get into it, but it seems they're playful when he throws that fish up out of the water onto the beach and she laughs at him. It seems like a natural kind of righteous relationship. And then you get to the New World and you see how horribly romance and sexuality was distorted and abused by excessive power, by evil use of power in the way that relationships are then forged. And again, I think that's a powerful, powerful commentary on American life because, of course, we're all sold this version of America, you know, God anointed and blah, blah, blah. No, Africa looks a lot better in this story, and I couldn't agree more.
But I would say one thing very quickly is that before, you know, you were talking about him, you know, either going off to study or, you know, his father wanting him to go into war. Remember what they said during the manhood ceremony was the most important thing for a Mandinka warrior to do is to marry and have a family.
Yes, yes.
And build his nation. That was more important than war because what his father said about war is easy to go into war, it's harder to get out of it.
That was the line he used. Lester, why don't you leap in here?
Yeah, just two things. So one thing, what struck me about those dynamics was one of the things that I recognize this time around is that the worship of Islam is actually also an introduction into African societies in a lot of times through conquest and slavery, right? So that kind of complicates, it shows a lot of variance between African nations, and then it implies that secondarily, one of the dynamics that was going on in in Black America at the time, something we're still living with, as well as in intellectual circles, is a set of questions about the Black family, about what its status is, about what its role is in keeping Black people back and in keeping society back. And one of the central arguments at the time was that it was Black family cultural dysfunction that was keeping Black people back, and at best, that cultural dysfunction was actually created by slavery. So you actually see that a little bit implied in that first episode, and to the extent we need to think about what Roots does for us now versus 1977, I think it'd be interesting to see to the extent to which it pushes back against that narrative, because that narrative has actually been pretty hurtful, and it's empirically wrong.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think that's why I'm very curious to see what the rest of these episodes do, and once this series is finished, I'm very curious to have an in-depth conversation about what we've all seen. The only person who's seen them all so far among us is David Zerwick.
And I'll give nothing away, no spoilers to your audience. Listen. Last night I was sitting on I live in Hamilton about 8 blocks from here, and I was sitting on my porch. My wife and I were working. My wife was working in the front yard. I was sitting on my porch, as one of my neighbors pointed out. But a good neighbor came by Ed and said, "Zerwick, you know, I read this review about Roots, but Game 7, come on." I said, "Well, what are you going to do, Ed?" He said, "I'm going to watch Game 7. Sheila, his wife's going to be upstairs watching Roots, and we're going to keep running up and down between the two." When Lester said he had to watch the game, and Carla said she watched, I think this was going on all over America.
I watched the end of the game.
And that's what we didn't have in 1970.
That's right. That's right. Good point.
So we watched the game, which you had to watch in real time. And then see Roots. He came on back-to-back like 3 times on the History Channel last night. So you could totally do it. Okay. And like 3 other cable networks.
So when's it? I don't know this. This sounds like a silly question before we go to break. I'm going to open the phones to Chris. And Chris and Adube and Ernest, your next callers up. We're going to come to your calls, 410-319-8888. But so when's the next episode? Is it tonight or next week?
Yeah, each night. Each night. 4 nights straight, 2 hours each.
4 nights
straight.
That's
right. But the right caller's right. They're airing them in rotation, and you can see them on Lifetime. You can see them on History. You can see them on the A&E channel. So you can tune in pretty much any time and probably find an episode if you check the listing.
I think it's important
for us. You can see it online anytime.
Yes. or that thing called the Internet. Thank you.
That's how I watch it. I watch it online.
Okay, so I do want to explore when we come back from this break, after we get to the phones, about what did the original Roots change the nature of media at all, and what's been produced, and looking now at this kind of series of films and TV shows that have come out. I'm thinking about Underground, which I watched that series. I don't watch a lot of TV on anymore, but I watched Underground. And what this dynamic shift is happening. And also, there's a lot of argument being made by other people I've been talking to, writing back and forth over the last couple of days, which is that this is just a slave narrative without any substance in terms of a critique of capitalism or how slavery engendered it, and we never can get to that in film. So I want to wrestle with those two things when we come back a little bit for this quick break, and also get a lot of people calling in, so we have a lot of calls to get to as well. We'll be right back as we explore the new series Roots. Opening day was last night. Watch it tonight, and then next week we'll have a postmortem after you have a chance to watch the whole thing. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Mark Steiner here with Carla Will, senior news producer at Democracy Now!, Dr. Lester Spence, associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Knocking the Hustle, and David Zerwick, Baltimore Sun media critic and assistant professor in the Department of Communication and Media Studies at Goucher College, and you at 410-319-8888. Let's go right to the phones and then come and have our guest respond, 410-319-8888. Chris, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Mark. I love your show. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
All right. My comment is a quick comment. It's just, you know, me personally, you know, it's possibly a good thing that they, you know, they're trying to re-portray Roots on TV. But I remember when Roots first came out. I was born in 1977. I was a child, and I remember when Roots would come out for a week, right? And they would play that the entire week. But then they would play Shaka Zulu too. And then this is my point though. Shaka Zulu portrays the black African male as royalty. And Roots, like all of these other big money films that white people choose to put out, the box office chooses to put out, are all about slaves and Marion and Pappy and all of this type of stuff. But what you could bring back Roots, but the same person who thought to bring back Roots was exposed to Shaka Zulu. Why wouldn't you bring back Shaka Zulu, which portrayed, and I think black people need that more now than ever, that portrays black people as royalty before we even came to the Western Hemisphere as slaves. You see what I'm saying?
Alessio, let me let you jump on that first.
Yeah, I think that's I think a lot of people probably share the brother's sentiment. My own point is that if I were to just to focus, for example, on my own family, on the Spences from, say, 1910 to now, where you got family suffering from Jim Crow, then family suffering from Northern racism, I can find enough stuff in there to give me everything I need culturally. Now, the argument implied in that comment is that somehow what black people need to see is kings and queens, in part to deal with this cultural dysfunction that we that we're dealing with. I don't agree that we have a cultural dysfunction problem. I think we have a racism problem, and that dynamic is on whites. To that extent, what we need to see is American history and to see how black folk have altered American dynamics and how American dynamics have helped shape what it means to be black. I mean, I actually remember Shaka Zulu. I think I'd be all down for a remake of that, but we're here in America, and if I have to choose, I would much rather see all types of stories told about slavery, about that specific moment, than I would something that happened off continent.
And my remembrance is watching Shaka Zulu also, Carla, was it that too was really a white film.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, and the other thing I would also push back on is just that I think it's, for me, more powerful if I want to draw references from African society. For me, it's more powerful to see the village and the sophistication of the families and the people in Jufere than focus on African royalty. To me, that just speaks more to me just directly than anything else.
Yeah, I think there's the issue of how we wrestle with the enslavement of African people and the genocide of Native people that actually allowed room for plantations to be built for the enslavement of African people in this hemisphere, and how that is at the very root of capitalism itself. Without it, there would be no modern capitalism. Yeah. I mean, Lester, to me, one of the things we have to do is Roots doesn't get into that, but I think that's the next level of conversation that has to happen.
So I'm reading a book. I was reading a book called, last night before the game came on, called Democracy Against Capitalism. Right. It's basically about making an argument that political structures are really important to understand capitalism as economic structures are. And I'm looking in the index. And it's a great book. I'm looking at index and they have maybe two or three pages about slavery and maybe two or three pages about race. And it's like a 400 page book. Right.
Right.
If we allow for the argument that pieces of popular culture are supposed to speak to the present, then the question really is what do we need now in a remake of Roots? We don't need the same stuff we needed in 1977. We were just 4 years out from black people being able to elect representatives of their choice for all intents and purposes. What we do need is a set of narratives that really resituate capitalism slavery and other dynamics at the heart of the capitalist project. Going back to what people are arguing about now in history and in scholarship, like people are now understanding that capitalism is actually that American slavery or the transatlantic slave trade actually generated most of the dynamics we associated with advanced capitalism, right? And it's thing that you're right, that Roots, at least in this episode, Roots doesn't appear to get at. It definitely didn't get at it in 1977. But it's those types of pop culture projects that we actually need at this moment.
Dave, do you want to jump in on that?
Well, there's a couple things going on. One, the simple answer to the caller's question is a level of capitalism is that television, commercial network television especially, was the great image, was the great engine of post-war capitalism. They really sold this advanced consumer society. In fact, some people say that television was invented to sell Wall Street, to get people to buy credit cards, to buy new washers. That's why when you were saying you didn't get a color TV till 1977, I wanted to say, oh, Bill Paley from CBS, or no, the guy at NBC, Sarnoff, David Sarnoff, the founder of CBS, would have been very upset with you because he was selling them with women in floral-colored gowns walking around them in the 60s. So they really did, and so in a sense, the simple answer is why this remake instead of Shaka Zulu. One is because of the audience, and because people thought, well, we can remake this and be commercially successful and make money. That's the sad truth. And I think sometimes people don't, I mean, certainly the people at this conversation do, but I think sometimes viewers don't recognize how tied American commercial television is to Madison Avenue and to the economic forces in this country. I mean, it exists to sell it. And when push comes to shove, that's where they stop. Now, the saving thing is there's this, I think Douglas Kellner, maybe Kellner's the last name, wrote a great essay called The Emancipatory Power, I think, of Popular Culture. And every so often, even in this web, things break through popular culture that are liberating, that are forces, progressive forces. For example, CBS sending cameras down to the South to cover civil rights marches. All of a sudden, that's in every living room. You know, if they had thought it through, I think they would have said, oh, maybe we can't afford to send cameras. You know, that's kind of thing that happens. Roots, I think, had some of that kind of power, that emancipatory power that wasn't particularly understood going into it. And, you know, Lester gives this very sophisticated argument about where we were in some ways as a nation at that time, which is, I think, is great. Sitting in Detroit and him looking at it from his point of view, I thought, that's exactly what was going on Lafayette Boulevard when I was there.
Yeah, that's right.
It is. So that's the answer one. And I think that idea of capitalism is really important. And I won't give any spoilers away in this, but they do talk in this one a little more about how slaves as property that can get you money when you're in trouble, sort of. You know, drunken plantation owners who are horrible, you know, are not just horrible people, but they're bad business persons. Oh, well, we can use these human beings to solve our financial problems. That's really the level I saw it at,
And it's touched on a little bit. I mean, and even in the first episode when they talk about, I mean, they're clearly a commodity, and the brothers are talking about the debt that he has between them. And we thought, we said we weren't going to buy anymore, and you know, I can get more, you know, if I sell this one, then I can settle that debt or whatever, you know. So they're clearly just trading human beings for capital, and that was
I'm gonna open the phones here again. It'd be interesting when we have the wrap up of this series to hear what of someone like Haile Gerima, Sankofa, I think one of the most important films ever made, thought about this series. I'm curious to see what people like that think about this as well. 410-319-8888. Back to the phones. Ernest, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I'm reading where Roots was plagiarized by Alex Haley. He was sued two times, and only one was successful. The original author of Roots, which was called The African Boy, was by Harold Courlander. And Haley admitted to using a lot of his information. By the way, Harold Courlander is a white male author, novelist. He used a lot of his information and put it into Roots. And a lot of the stuff that he put into Roots, the African traditions and stuff like that, was not true. And also, the genealogy, the Gambian griot and all that stuff in reference to the village where he was born, all that stuff is not, according to this article on the internet, it's not true. Even Dr. Henry Louis Gates said the fact that he traced his roots back to this village is probably not true. So I don't know how a person, it should be a caveat saying, Roots, yes, Alex Haley wrote, but he plagiarized it from another author. Well, I don't think professor or a scholarly person, if you turned in a plagiarized work at college at Hopkins, I mean, they wouldn't be talking about it and celebrating. You'd be getting an F, maybe be getting kicked out of school.
So let's talk about that for a minute, because that has been part of the saga of Roots, David Zurich.
Yeah, a couple of things on that. The statement that the caller is making, Ernest, is he plagiarized. I wouldn't be able in any way to say it with that definitive nature. And that's the nature of the Internet. You're a killer, but there was never actually, determined that you killed somebody, but somebody said it. So, I never felt comfortable with the evidence calling him a plagiarist. That's number one. Number two, there was an out-of-court settlement with the author you mentioned. Again, doesn't prove anything necessarily, except there was an out-of-court settlement, so you couldn't get beyond that. Number three, I have to tell you this. Having been there in the mainstream press in 1977, Haley's tremendous success when this book then came out, and then the Pulitzer Prize, and I mean, you ultimately would go on to win a Pulitzer Prize, and his miniseries. There was still in this culture, very much in the mainstream press, a kind of, it's more than backlash. It's much more complicated than that. But if a person of color, especially a black man, achieves something of that stature, the dominant mainstream press really was looking in a way to tear him down in a way that I don't think they did on an equal basis. I mean, we're skeptical and cynical, and that's our job, to be a watchdog. But this was special. You remember Dr. Martin Luther King's dissertation and all the business that went on in connection with that. Somebody reached a certain level of power in our culture, and that was one of the backlash things that happened. Now, I'm not saying, again, I'm not an expert on it, and I can't tell you one way or the other what happened, but I was aware of that, and I was very careful in a sort of self-ethnographic sense. And I went back through that process again when I wrote this, and I sat with my editor, and we said, how should we handle that? And she said, the way it ultimately wound up in the paper was claims or allegations of plagiarism, comma, despite that, blah, blah, blah. This is a great piece of work. Also, this is a work, I think, of mythology. And mythology is sort of a collection of folklore, epic stories, all kinds of things in the culture. The author still has to stitch all that material together into a compelling, moving, resonant, powerful, inspiring narrative. And even if he borrowed here, here, and here, that's what happens in mythology. And he was the guy who put that all into a format, found a storyline that made it resonate the way it did. So I'm not saying, Ernest, I'm not saying the piece you have on the Internet isn't true. I'll tell you what, in my job as a reporter, and I'm a pretty hard-nosed reporter, I hope, I couldn't say what that person in the Internet said about him. He's a plagiarist. There are issues, I can tell you factually, there are issues, there were court cases, but a plagiarist, I'm not ready to call him that.
Do you, either one of you want to jump in on that, Carl, before we move to the caller or Lester?
Yeah, he settled a case out of court. So it's likely that he took passages out of the novel and out of another piece and put it into his and claimed it as his own. But I think so to that extent, calling it a piece of history would be inaccurate. And it's also possible that he embellished a lot on his ability to find the exact home of his family. But the thing is, if you look at it as kind of a piece of creative nonfiction isn't quite the word. But if you look at it as more of a myth-making enterprise, there's nothing in there that jumps out as being so wrong as it to not be worthy to be put on film.
I agree.
Yeah, and I want to underscore what David said. I mean, when a piece is successful and at upsetting, you know, the status quo as Roots was, you know, you, and especially from an African-American creator, you can expect folks to come after him. And I think a lot of the folks who are pointing the finger at this, you know, should also keep that in mind, that, you know, folks are going to come after Alex Haley for that. It was still a brilliant, beautiful piece of work.
You know, that's a great point by Carla, too, that it was upsetting. It upset people. The happy tales.
Right.
You know, Norman Mailer said slavery's our original sin, and it's the thing we can't talk about. That's why we're still so nuts. And I'm he was talking about the white culture and white America. I think that Roots said in your face, you come from really some bad roots here in this stuff. And they wanted to tear them down for that. I really agree. That's a great point, Carla.
Let's go back to the phones here. I'm sorry we missed some of these calls. Call back. We'll try to get you in. 410-319-8888. Monroe, you're on the air.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good morning.
I've been listening to a lot of conversation, and my concern is I understand Alex Haley, understand slavery. I'm proud to be black, and I will be 60 years old this year. But the thing is, there's a lot of black intellectuals in this country, and I feel we're not really looking at the problem in such a way that we can correct it and correct it permanently. Case in point, I live in Baltimore. I've seen all of these young people dying almost every day. I've had a guy last week at 7 gunshots in my car, 22 years old. And it's just getting very aggravating that we as a people don't seem to be able to analyze the situation, understand it, consume it, and create a solution. And I think we can do it. And I think the problem is we need to get out of the box, understand the game, and use the elements of the game to change the game. And I think we have that ability, but we're not doing it. We're going around in circles about our history, but we need to think about the future. I'm seeing too many of our young people dying, and it's terrible to have the elders bearing the young. And that's pretty much telling me we're bearing our future. That needs to stop. That's my comment. If there's at some point that we can have some commentary to talk about the solutions.
Well, I think if you tune in, we grab restful solutions here every day and every week. There's not a week goes by we don't pour into that whole question of solutions and push very hard on those things. I think you're right. We have to do that. So let me just take a piece of what you said, because I mean, I think that's something that's coming up again this week. We'll be doing it next week. We'll be doing it all the time. We have to deal with that reality and how we restructure the city so there's control, which can take place. And I think many political leaders are afraid to answer that question. But having heard what you said, one of the things, Lester, when I hear things about what Monroe just said, I want to twist a little bit to think about how does our understanding of the history, looking at the cultural responses to who we are, affect the kind of things Monroe is talking about? Is it too far to make that leap? I'm not so sure it is. I was thinking about my conversation with Manisha Sinha about her incredible book, The Slave's Cause, which is, I think, the best history of the abolition movement I've ever read. It gives you a perspective on that history, gives you a perspective on who we are now and the struggles we are in now when you see how the struggles were fought in this country for those 200 years. So that slavery, the narrative of slavery and enslavement also teaches us something.
Yeah, so I'm going to use a scene from Roots to talk a little bit about to get at something that your caller might be dealing with. One of the problems that I think a lot of folk don't quite understand is that institutional change is incredibly hard, right? Even if we're not, and then once we add a kind of racism and class dynamics into it, it's even harder, right? So one of the things, so people routinely ask, and they ask this about slavery, like why weren't there more insurrections? Why weren't there more rebellions? Why weren't there more successes, right? You look at that attempt to take the boat, when the slaves are on the boat, or they're not even, they're captives at that moment. They're captives. The African captives are on the boat and they're trying to take it, and they end up failing, even though they have greater numbers. It's because the forces that were arrayed against them had more material strength and had more institutional power. They spoke the same language, right? That's not a dynamic of culture. That's not black people not knowing. That's not black people not figuring it out. That's just them being faced with superior strength, with superior numbers. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I talked earlier about what Roots needs to do now. The reason I talk about what Roots needs to do now versus 1977 is because our present shapes how we view the past and what we need the past for, right? And if you go, so going back, it's not a coincidence that scholars are starting to understand the role slavery played in capitalism again as capitalism is starting to fail. Right, it's not a coincidence that that the best-selling books about slavery over the last few years all take that approach. So there's something to be said for folks in general trying to problem solve what we need, trying to figure out what it is we do to keep more kids from being killed and more elders burying their kids. But there are a number of folks that are doing that, and then in a program like Roots, if properly structured. Again, I haven't seen the rest. Can actually help us as opposed to keeping us distracted from more contemporary questions.
That's really well said, Carla.
Yeah, I mean, and I think in addition, another institution that is often seen as failing, in addition to capitalism, is basically the family, in particular the black family. And I think this being this saga, and you know, the original tagline for Roots was the saga of an American family. If we still, and again, I don't know how it plays out in the rest of the episodes, but if it still really focuses on this family and how it continues to tell its story and tries and fights to hold itself together. I think those are lessons I think we're all looking, you know, to learn from, as far as, you know, because at the end of the day, and it kind of goes back to what they talked about in the village, you know, it's about building and maintaining your family, which is nation building. I mean, if that's what we're talking about needing to do, those are lessons that, you know, we can look to the past to try to figure out how do we do it. I found that a lot of the conversations I have now, it's about that struggle, about, you know, the family unit, whether it is traditional family, but whatever family community unit happens in the space that you are, is critical to being a part of a larger structure where they're, you know, just different spokes, you know, hubs and spokes on a ever larger, you know, kind of, you know, gears and wheel, you know what I mean? So I think that's something we learned from this story.
Yeah, I think that those were really important comments, because I think that we are, you know, when you look at this also, this story in the context of things that have been made more recently, I mean, from Sankofa being made in 1993, which I mentioned earlier, but just new TV series like The Underground, or Underground, not Underground.
The WGN series.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Underground? No, wait a minute. That's not what it's called. Yeah. Is it?
It's the it's WGN.
It is. Okay. I lost my mind for a moment. It's back now. But I think that this idea, at least whether it's the new Roots or the new films that are coming out, is the sense of empowerment in the stories about the period of enslavement. And it's about the story of people struggling and being leadership of struggling for their own liberation. Those two pieces have always gotten left out. And that's the kind of narrative I think has been that Roots allowed to take place in media that did not take place before, when it challenged the hegemony of Gone with the Wind and Birth of a Nation. And that, to me, is the kind of critical historical role it played culturally, for all the critique you might want to give it.
You know, this is, you know, back, I'm old enough when the television was just thought of as a frivolity, an entertainment thing, even though it was selling this ideology, you know? And this is why I went into it, because I believe television is this deep and this profound in some ways. And maybe it's only Lester and Carla's being deep and profound that made this sound this way. But you have this show, And it's helping engender critiques about capitalism and family, like we just heard from Lester and Carla, okay? You scratch America deep enough, and it's always about money. It's always about – that's who we are, capitalism, sad to say. No matter what, our media, anything, in the end, that's what the culture produces. It's changing, I think, in some ways because it's being forced on them, but – and family. This show, this primetime entertainment, quote, television, can engender that kind of discussion about our reality. That's a powerful, that's a worthwhile television production. I mean, that's my bottom line on it. If, you know, it doesn't do it on its own, but if it can help trigger that kind of discussion. Now, I said, Lester and Carla, and your show opens it up for this. But when you think about how the ecosystem of media in this country, the fact that this discussion then comes the morning after that show, that's an important television show.
No, I think, and for me, it was really important to kind of wrestle with this, and why I'm so anxious to see where this ends up in four episodes, and what we can say about that after these four episodes, and kind of wrestle with what we've seen, and also just the changing landscape of the media and the things people are seeing on television, and how that's affecting the dialogue, and how it also, in some ways, is also affecting the world of Trump.
You got another hour.
We'll do that in a few days. First of all, I want to just thank our guests. This has been really a phenomenal conversation. It's always good to have you with us. Carla Wills, senior news producer at Democracy Now. You're doing great work, and we'll see each other soon, I hope.
Definitely, Mark. I hope so. Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you here. And Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media, Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. A latest book, Knocking the Hustle Against a Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. And I think one of our leading thinkers anywhere in this country. Lester, good to have you with us once again.
Yeah, good to be here. I'll talk to you soon.
It's very soon. And my friend, Dr. David Zurwick. I love that. Dr. David Zurwick, who, of course, is the Baltimore Sun Media Critic, Assistant Professor in the Department of Communication and Media Studies at Goucher. Always good to have you, David. Thanks so much
for being here. Thank you. Oh, it was a privilege to be part of this discussion, Mark.
Don't be a stranger. Come on back. It's good having you here.
Only live a couple blocks away.
That's good. That's a good thing. And thank you all for calling in and writing in and making the show what it is. Wouldn't be anything without you. On our way out of here, I'll remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's Credit Union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's Credit Union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Mark Steiner Show, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you know, now that Roots is done, the 4 days of watching Roots has been done, and most people have seen it, we said we would gather again to kind of talk about the series once everybody has watched it and thought about it and seen what it said, since all of us just saw the first episode the last time that we spoke. Our panel today includes folks who have been on the show before and someone who has not. But it's great. It's a good panel here. We have Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, co-editor of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics in Africana Communities. Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media's Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Knocking the Hustle, The Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics, and before that, Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. And Lakima Pennyman, who is a rising senior here at Morgan State University. And welcome. Good to have you all with us here on the show.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, and I too watched it post. It was interesting. Just a reflection on how TV has changed for a moment, since you deal with media a lot and you think about media a lot. When this first aired in 1977, I was kind of checking out the numbers from back then, that 30 million households watched it because there were only three channels. 71% of TV sets in America were tuned in to Roots. It had this effect across a wide cross-racial spectrum of America that wrestled with slavery like it had never done before. And the irony is that I checked out something else, was that the program that previously had broken the record of viewers was the first television showing of Gone with the Wind.
Ooh, wow. Irony.
Irony, yeah, right? Wow, yeah. So, and this time, in the first few days of it, there were like 14 million viewers, 5.9 million the first night because we were watching basketball instead. Then they tuned in later and watched it later. So 14 million people watched it. So, so media is very different in terms of its effect and its impact on society. So I'm curious, as you juxtapose what the effect that Roots had in 1977 as opposed to where we are today with this new Roots, and how you think that will affect the dialogue. Just, I'd like to start there for just a second.
So I would say the first thing is very much so the fact that we were dealing with three network channels in 77 versus a slew of channels now, and also the capability with media to DVR and record it and view at a later date. So I didn't hear so many people talking about it each night as it was being played, but by the end of that week, on the weekend, so many families were talking about watching Roots then because they had had the opportunity to record it during the week and then use it as their time to watch later. And so the conversations, I think, are very different than what we were doing in 77. If there was such a thing as the water cooler in 77, many of us were able to have those conversations almost immediately because there were so many of us watching.
Because you all, but both of you and us were kids then when this came out.
We were.
But, and probably watched with your families, right?
Yeah.
Small tots.
Yeah.
Small tots. Well, I had small tots.
Yes, I did watch it. Yes, I did watch it when it first came on in 77. And so I think the difference very much is around what we have in terms of media technology to be able to gain access to those spaces. I also think it's interesting that, you know, not only was it the History Channel, but you also saw Lifetime, you also saw A&E, all of these other channels giving you access to that particular miniseries, again, in ways that did not occur in 77.
But the other technological thing that's going on is we've got so many more. It's not just we have so many more devices with which to consume it, and we have the opportunity to kind of change when and where we watch it. Like I basically binge watched it. You know, last night after the game, I had my priorities straight.
A lot of people do the first night of the Roots as well.
Yeah, same thing with the first night. Got to see what happens in the game. But there's also so many other streams that people are attuned to and thinking about and talking about, whether it's something like Hillary Clinton becoming the first female presidential candidate, you know, officially the Democratic candidate, whether it's Trump. Whether it is the game, whether it's the Book of Negroes, whether it's, you know, there are all these other streams kind of taking people's attention in all these different ways. So to that extent, it's difficult to see just with that technological stuff, it'd be difficult to see, to imagine Roots having the same type of discursive impact on people, you know, on how they thought about things, on how they, you know, lived their lives that that first series had.
Now I know you weren't there in 1977.
But I wasn't even a thought in 1977.
Exactly. But have you thought about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think I see this new series as bridging a gap because I've spoken to my peers about this and a lot of them haven't even seen the original series, right?
Or they've
seen.
You have?
I have not seen it.
Have not.
I've seen one episode and I saw it in like a social studies class in like ninth grade or something. But I knew of the series from it being parodied a lot, right? And so, like that famous scene where Kunta Kinte refuses to utter his slave name, I'd heard about that a lot and I'd seen it parodied a lot in the media, sort of comedically, sometimes seriously. But now that I've seen the new series, I'm more interested in seeing the original series. So I see the new series as sort of making younger people more interested in older media depictions of slavery and sort of interested in comparing it.
Just leap into that then. How did this series affect you?
Oof. It was sort of just like filmically traumatizing to watch, right? And that's sort of what it's supposed to do. But one thing that I did get out of it was sort of this concept of how So people are talking a lot about intergenerational trauma from slavery, but one thing that came out through the series was also intergenerational healing, like referring back to your ancestor and that being something that heals, right? And so the argument being that our ancestors don't leave us with just trauma, they also provide us with a path toward healing, was powerful for me. And so the particular scene I'm thinking of is when I think it's Tom sees the spirit of Kunta Kinte manifest.
The son of Chicken George when he was running to find his father.
Right, exactly. Right. And how that helps him find his father. Mm-hmm. I think that was a really beautiful scene.
Me too. That scene really struck me. There were a lot of scenes in this thing that struck me.
Right.
That was a very powerful spiritual moment. And you both, obviously, because when you were kids, you watched it. You may have rewatched The Old Roots again. I don't know. My guess is, knowing your media bent carefully, you probably have. But I wonder how you – the difference. I mean, because one of the things that struck me about the difference between these two roots, and I see what you all think, is that there were – in the original roots, there were a lot of bones thrown to white people to make it more palatable. There weren't so many bones thrown in this one to make things palatable.
Which was a good thing.
Right? Mm-hmm. No, right. But that's, I think, the difference between – one of the major differences here for me.
Yeah. So I think two of the main differences that stood out to me or resonated most with me, and I watched with my children, which was interestingly enough, because I've been on other shows with you where folks have said, we just need to show it to our children. And I've always kind of struggled with that. And they're now 10 and 12. And I did keep playing with the idea literally 2 hours up to the beginning of the series beginning. And but I recalled, I actually had the opportunity to see the first episode at a White House screening a couple of weeks beforehand. And many of the actors were there, including the young man Malachi Kirby, who played Kunta Kinte, was present. And I posed a question to him kind of off the side with a glass of wine, when would you show this to your child? And he's much younger, so he doesn't have children, and he wasn't able to give the same kind of context that I would as a parent. But he did say, for a mature 14-year-old. And I said, well, my children aren't quite there yet. And he said, however, what I also want to say to you is that because of the access to media that our children now have, do you want to be put in a position where your son gets the opportunity to see segments of this miniseries and you're not there to provide context? And so literally that's what resonated with me immediately that 2 hours before, that I want to be here. I want to be a part of that conversation. I don't want someone given the urban legend version of what all of this means. I need to be the one to make sure I impart the perspective that I want my children to take away from with this. So that's why I decided to watch it and watch it with them. The two pieces that resonated most with me, I would say, would be the role of Islam in the miniseries, right, which I loved seeing. Mm-hmm. That's not the knowledge that we had nor were willing to showcase early on, certainly in the 77 version of Roots. But I love seeing that we were willing to explore that and recognize that there is not this natural stream of we were Christians and in this, way in which we construct Christianity back in West Africa, and we just brought it over with us to America. I also enjoyed seeing how the directors play with the racial hierarchy in the series, in particular dealing with the Irish, and how there was a clear message being communicated of, you're not one of us either. And how that created this intense struggle between many of the Irish overseers and the slaves, the enslaved people, as well as the overseers or the Irish with the English, who were the so-called real slave owners or slave masters.
There are a few places that I don't actually think I wouldn't show this. I'd show this to my oldest, obviously. She's an adult.
Okay, your kids are young, some of them. Yeah,
yeah, but my younger ones, my two youngest ones, about to be 13 in a few weeks and 11. I don't think I wouldn't show this to them. It's a lot more violent, actually, than that. It's a lot more violent than that first series.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah. A lot more violent. I mean, with without saying how it happened, anytime you see somebody's face get blown off, right? I mean, that's real violence. And I wouldn't show that to them. I would talk to them if they end up seeing it somewhere else and they ask me questions, I would. But I think that's an interesting question. You know, how do you engage in this dialogue about something like this with the kids? What did I like about it? What did I appreciate? I appreciated it wasn't just that they that they didn't give that many bones to white people. What they did, though, was reveal the deep violence that's embedded in Southern culture, right? And the interracial elements are the ones that are starkest to us, but it was deeply, whites were deeply violent to each other. I mean, deeply violent, right? And I focused in the first episode about the economy. There were a number of elements there where it's clear the role capital played in the relationships, the role capital played in the households. The one thing there are a couple of things I push back on. I wish they would have done better. And this might be a money issue. I really wish they would have had people speaking in their African language when they were act. I really would have preferred a subtitled. You know, subtitled roots when they were on the other side of the continent, mm-hmm. right? When they were actually in Africa, there's no need for us to hear people with, you know, English but in African accents. That's something I wish they would have kind of drove home. Another interesting element, somebody mentioned this on Facebook. Chicken George was played by Ben Vereen in the original episode. But Chicken George was the progeny of one of the white masters and and it was a rape. It was a product of a rape. Right. It's highly unlikely that a white man and a black woman have a kid that's as dark as Ben Vereen, right? So it's cool that they kind of got that shade right. Give it a shout out to Team Light Skin in a different way. It's kind of cool they got that shade right. Like, wow, yeah, that looks like it could be Chicken George.
I appreciate a lot about the series, but as far as throwing bones to white people, I didn't see that so much. And like I said, I haven't seen the original series yet. But what did you all think about the scene with the white woman being hanged with the other black man? Because for me, filmically, it was sort of making this argument that there's a system of white patriarchy that is sort of yoking white women and black men in the same way. And this is a common analysis, right, that like analogizes white women and black men. Just them both dying at the same time in the same way, sort of fighting the same struggle. Does that for me? And one, I tried to find historical reference to an actual white woman who had been hanged for betraying the Confederacy, and I couldn't find it. And so I was just wondering, besides sort of trying to, I guess, make this argument about white patriarchy, what was the purpose of that scene?
You know, so, and before I think that's a great question, but the other thing I really liked, the other thing I really liked, is it really foregrounded the role women played,
right.
Black women mm-hmm. played in a variety of forms of resistance.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas I think the first episode, the first series, I do remember Leslie Uggams. I think Leslie Uggams. Mm-hmm. She played Kizzy. Mm-hmm. Yes. She played a powerful. It was a powerful role. But in a number of instances, you see black women outside of Kizzy, actually. And this sounds stereotypical, holding down a fort. But more a richer way of saying it is kind of exhibiting strong traits of resilience. And strong and constrained, but there was still like agency. You still saw them expressing agency.
Well, even on the slave ship, you have the opportunity to see that with the enslaved women at that point, helping to communicate with the men of what they should do in order to try an insurrection on the ship.
Well, they were speaking.
And that's where they were actually speaking.
Speaking Mandinka. Yes, right.
They were also singing, right? They were also singing.
Yeah.
But I think it is interesting, this whole notion of how white patriarchy is played out, of how we then further subjugate or marginalize white women as well. But I think it speaks back to Lester's point about the amount of violence that existed in a culture that always saw itself on top. And so these are the means in which we have to go to in order to maintain that structure. And she came upon in that process.
And it was, to me, it was like when you watch that and I don't know historically of, and I'm going to look this up, but of any white women who were necessarily hanged. But I do know that after reading and talking so much with Manisha Sinha and her book, The Slave's Cause, that a lot of white people who were in the abolition movement were killed and tortured in the course of the struggle over 200 years.
So we have examples in the civil rights movement, right?
Right.
I mean, so it's fairly consistent in order to maintain this system. This is what, these are the links that we're willing to go to in order to make sure it does not get derailed, regardless of who you happen to look like.
So I wonder, you know, that is a really interesting point, you know, and I thought that because that was a very the scene, as many scenes in this series of Roots sticks out. That's one of the scenes that stays in your head, right?
And I didn't. By the way, I didn't
like it.
I didn't like it either. For the reason, the first thing is like, okay, what's the odds? This has to be. I mean, granted, the whole thing is a piece of, it's a truth, but it's not literal truth, is a metaphorical truth, but I was like, this isn't right.
So the other part, you mentioned Islam, and I think that this is really an important piece because we never talk, at least in Satat, very much in schools about at least if not more, 1/3 of the enslaved Africans here were Muslim, and led many of the rebellions that took place. I mean, that's never talked about, and in some ways, this was almost. I put this. I mean, the family lineage here was spiritual and non-religious, including not Christian. Kunta Kinte and his descendants in this piece, which I found really interesting. But that was a tension in the movie that they didn't explore with depth, but they explored through dialogue between enslaved people. I found that really interesting.
And I also found it interesting how peaceful a religion we were given the opportunity to see Islam, which is a direct counter message to all that we hear about Islam in present day. I mean, by those that understand it as a faith, we have a sense of what that foundation looks like. But in terms of how it gets perpetuated in media to us, there's nothing peaceful about this as a religion at all. When everything that was given to us was a way of seeing Islam as a way of, this is how we do peace. This is how we work together. And we don't have to, we only enter into battle when it's necessary.
I'd really like to explore a little bit. I mean, it's something you mentioned earlier, Lester, before we walked in the studio, and I've been thinking about all through watching Roots, is what the series said about family, about men and women separately, and about resistance. That to me, which did not come through in some ways, though it did in some levels, but not as intensely. In the first series in 1977. This really was a major focus, I think, was family, what it meant to be a man, what it meant to be a woman, and resistance to enslavement. The way they depicted it just was, I think, hugely forceful and powerful.
Yeah, I agree. And there's an open question about... So a series like Roots... Alex Haley wrote Roots... To tell a story, sure, but really to make a certain claim, a certain set of claims about what America was, a certain set of claims about what the American family was, but also a certain set of claims about the black family specifically, about where it came from, about what shapes it, what forces shapes it, what forces cause it to take the form that it does. And it's even as people in places like Baltimore, Detroit, black families in places like Baltimore, Detroit, Gary, et cetera, are racked by deep structural subjugation, there's this cultural narrative that attends that, that comes with that story that Alex Haley is telling, that I'm not sure we even needed a 1970 versus now, right? That is the kind of a cultural story that black people are where they black people have come from. Black people have come a long way, but one of the things that keeps black people relatively sane is them knowing where they come from. And the closer you can kind of get to Africa as far as your knowledge of where you come from, the more sane you're going to be. And I don't think that's right empirically, and I think that has problematic consequences politically.
And so it's interesting because for me, it wasn't so much of the black family as it was the name, that it was significant to hold on to the name. And I believe the idea of naming is as powerful then as it is now, where, I mean, I'm sure we can share stories about, you know, your five children, my two children, why those names were given and that they mean something.
My middle name is Kenyatta.
Right.
And your dad calls you Kenyatta.
And everybody in the neighborhood knows me as Kenyatta. They don't know who Lester is.
So it has something to it, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
It carries weight. Mm-hmm. And so for me, and at least what I heard articulated from my 10 and 12-year-old is how important it was that they embrace the names that they have, right? And understanding that mommy and daddy chose these names for particular reasons because they have meaning and that they are to carry out the significance of those particular names that were given to them. So I will say, though, in terms of the black family connection, that is one of the subplots of the series that stood out to my 12-year-old the most. My son kept talking about, why do they keep messing up the black family? Is how he articulated. Why do they keep messing up the black family? It seems like when the black family is together, you know, the slave master is always separating them and taking parts of the family away. I mean, we see that in the first episode when Kunta Kinte gets to the first plantation, that there are members of families being sold off, and you see kind of the anguish of the various family members that they're being separated. So I do think that is significant. I don't have the same kind of connection that Lester does about this being a narrative that keeps getting told to be then explained, this is why we are where we are now. I guess I'm rebuking that piece and not getting caught up in it because I am focused on the fact that in spite of those things, here is where we are and this is what we need to do to kind of move forward.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, Kima?
That's interesting.
We're going to take a short break. We're going to come right back. We're talking about Roots. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, you just heard. Lakeemah Penniman, Dr. Lester Spence, stay with us. We'll be right back to continue our conversation about Roots. And on our way to break, I want to remind you, The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn more about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or at SteinerShow.org is the Maryland State Education Association's banner. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we continue our conversation about Roots and this latest Roots, obviously, with three people here in the studio, two of whom you know very well from their time in the studio, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, co-editor of Black Berries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body, Politics, and Africana Communities, who actually saw the first episode of Roots, as we talked about in the first segment, at the White House, the some of the folks who made the film itself. Dr. Lester Spence is a Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Knocking the Hustle, Neoliberal Turn of Black Politics, which is getting a lot of play in the world, as it should, and Stare in the Darkness, Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, and Lakeema Pennyman, who is a rising senior at Morgan State University and a political activist in our community.
I see the series as sort of making an argument about sort of families and the legitimacy of calling something a family despite certain units within a family being absent, right? And so slavery sort of balkanizes people and tears apart families. But and you can sort of link this today with like prison industrial complex and how there are absences within black families because of that. But I guess just regardless of whether or not a person is actually there, their presence remains and impacts that family, right? And so that's you see that with Chicken George and how he gets sent far away. But people within his family sort of tell his children about him.
So one quick thing. Note that in this series, as in the previous series, all the families are quote-unquote straight. There are no queer. There are no queer conceptions of family at all.
Right? In,
there
are, some of the roots.
In roots. There aren't any.
That's true. That would have been a step. That would have been an interesting step to put that in. I think that because
And certainly, the generation that we're in, I could easily see that.
Really good
being
point. I never thought about that.
And it had to have existed, right? I mean, so to get back, I was talking to my dad about this stuff, and there was two elderly men who lived next door to me when I was growing up in Inkster, around the time when Roots was out.
Wow.
And now I'm realizing, I'm like, they had to have had a relationship. I mean, I knew them, Ted and Joe. We would talk all the time. They had to have been in a relationship. None of them had been married that I was aware of. They didn't have any children. They had nieces and nephews, but they didn't have kids. So one argument would be in response, well, okay, they didn't exist then. But no, they had to have existed.
Absolutely.
Right? So it would have been really interesting to actually have that, at least that.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's a really good point.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I'm thinking about it now, but the only sort of bit of queerness that you do get is with Kizzy and the white girl. I remember a scene when they're playing in nightgowns together, and I think the white woman tries to lift up her dress to see. And so it's sort of being aligned with like predatory whiteness again, which is an old trope, right?
But that predatory whiteness was all through
Roots
and all kinds of levels in this piece, which also wasn't as blatant in the previous Roots as it was in this one.
So at this screening, Mark Wolper, the executive director, was also present. Executive producer. And he also talked about deciding to redo his dad's work because he had shown Roots to his teenage son and it didn't resonate with him. Mm. And he said, that's not possible considering the significance of what this story means. Yeah. And so he figured there was a need to retell the story in a way that is digestible for generations such as this, right? And because think about it. We watched Roots for a number of days. This was a 4-day, 2-hour night, right? We're watching it from 8 to 11 each night for, I know, at least 7 days.
Yeah, it was 6 days. It was over six days, I think. Yeah.
What? I was trying to think. I was like, man. How I knew? I'm like, wow. And this is a trifling way to think about it.
It was several hours longer,
that's
too.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
like, man, they cut off his foot pretty quick.
Yes. And he talked about that there was a need to tell the story in very shorter segments that still covered a lot of lay of the land, so to speak, time frame, right? And so we do, I mean, by the second episode, we're already cutting off a foot.
That's right.
And that doesn't happen in the original Roots so quickly. But he said that there was a need to do that because, again, he felt like telling the story in a way that would make it digestible for this generation to get their heads around how quickly the story can be told and still give you the power power, which is why I think, Lester, your point about the amount of violence in it comes at us so quickly. Because it was night two that I had two other people laying in my bed with me, right? Because my children were impacted by the amount of violence that happened in night two versus the other three nights. That was the one that seemed to just be so too vivid for them to say, okay, now I can go and sleep in my own bed. And so I think it's just interesting that he saw the need to retell this story because I was one of those that begrudgingly said, why the hell are you touching this? Why are you touching this?
Yeah.
Because it was fine as it was. We just I've got the 25th anniversary DVD set of Roots in my house on my bookshelf, and I said, when my son gets older as a teenager, we'll share this with him. And so I didn't think it needed to be touched. But after seeing it and seeing how the story gets told, I got it. I understood. I mean, in fact, I remember someone tweeting saying the original Roots was like a soap opera, and this is more of like an action film.
No question.
And that makes it something that I think this generation can embrace much better.
Underground, that's the same thing. It's more of an action film. So coming back to this, there's one thing I always think about was before we come back to some issues around family I want to raise with you all, but I was thinking about the context when these things were written, done. When this was done in 1977, it was 13 years after the signing of the Civil Rights Act and legal segregation was killed in this country. And which was a very different time period. It was a time period in some ways of rising black expectation politically and involvement in politics. Things were growing in a very different way that you write about in your book, right, in that period. And this is written at a time when we are wrestling with something just as deep in the 21st century from Katrina to Barack Obama's becoming president of the United States, an African-American man as president of the United States of America, whatever you think politically about his regime or his time in office is not, I'm not talking about, but the fact that he is president of the United States and a black man is president of the United States of America, to the explosion of the Black Lives Matter movement and the exposition of a kind of brutality by the police departments across the country that can't be ignored because now they're on videotape. So we're in a very different moment dealing with the depths of racism in America. So how does that – what does that context say?
So what I talked about last time was that that at the time Roots was created, there were still a number of people in the academy and the ideas from the academy matter for the rest of us. People in the academy basically saying that slavery was a good thing or that slavery wasn't that bad or that slavery wasn't that extensive. Et cetera, et cetera.
1977.
Yeah, 1977. Right. And what Roots does is basically what Roots helps Roots helps serve the function, maybe more than anything else, of saying, okay, all that stuff is wrong. That stuff is wrong. Slavery was brutal. It was fundamental to America. It was fundamental to the South. And it basically created the conditions for most of the stuff we have. You know, the way that black people live now is a direct consequence of this. The moment we have now is kind of different, right, in that we all know, you know, because of Roots, we all know, you know, how bad slavery was. We all have a sense. But what the major mainstream conversations in the academy are about the role of capitalism, the role of slavery in actually developing what we know is capitalism, right? So one way to think about it, one argument about capitalism is that you really get your profits if people are working on their own behalf. Right. If people are working freely, so to speak. Right. And what the data pretty much shows is that slave labor was highly productive. Right. People who did not have control of their labor produced incredible profits, you know, for the South, and that those profits drove industrialization in the States doesn't occur without that. So and then you add that to modern day discussions about segregation, about hypersegregation, you know, the Baltimore case, the black butterfly and the white L, that shows consistently how black folk and poor folk are kind of synonymous. It's that story that we need, to the extent we need stories like Roots dealing with that period. It's a story more appropriate to the time that we need. And that's what I don't think Roots gave us. So to that extent, I do kind of wish that instead of revisiting Roots, they would have maybe told another set of stories about the same time period.
It's interesting because I actually, and I mentioned this at the beginning of the segment, I actually really appreciated this conversation about the racial hierarchy that gets at least explored in Roots in ways that didn't happen in the first one. And so one of the things that stands out to me in terms of time periods, like why we're doing this now and how it gets told, is at least in the Ivory Tower, we've been having these conversations, or the creation of even areas of study such as whiteness studies, right? And so the buzzwords of white privilege, white tears, white fatigue, I mean, all of that we have been immersed in, especially in the 2000s. And so here then pops up at the same time where we've got this backlash about PC language being used, and of course then the rise of someone like Donald Trump on the scene, on the political scene. At the same time, we have a retelling of a story in which we have the opportunity to see how this whiteness thing actually was being carried out, even during a period of Africans being enslaved in this country, where we see the distinctions of what whiteness looks like, who has access to it, who doesn't have access to it, and how people were treating each other as a result of this understanding of whiteness. We may not have been calling it that at that time, but clearly it was manifested. And so for me, the time period of us telling the story now matters because we have an opportunity to hear and see in a more explicit way how whiteness was being constructed for us before our very eyes, and how it now has manifested itself, or why we see whiteness being carried out the way it is today.
Kima.
That's interesting. I actually saw this series as sort of commenting on this political era we're in right now. I guess in a sort of roundabout way with in the series, the Civil War and its end, and how they demonstrate that it actually doesn't end with the surrender of the Confederacy. And so you have, I think they're called the Bushwhackers, who are still terrorizing black people. And you kind of see the beginnings of the genesis of the Ku Klux Klan. And so the point that they made was that, okay, on paper, black people are free, just like now, politically on paper. We have certain rights and we have a black president, but these benefits don't actually manifest themselves in real life for black peoples.
And, you know, thinking about it, one of the things this is a very powerful series for me. I mean, watching it was just very intense. I found myself clenching my hands a lot, fists, and just getting really tight watching this piece. I started thinking about that later. And I started thinking about how there are a series of films and TV shows being made, whether it's Underground, 12 Years a Slave, things that have been made much more recently. And I was thinking about this whole body of work over the last 50 years that has been made about the Holocaust. All kinds of dramatic films. Never stop. And as someone wrote, I remember it was interesting, there was this debate between people saying enough slave movies, and then somebody I saw wrote in return, you don't see the Jewish community saying enough Holocaust movies. Stop. Right? I mean, but what I think is important about what's happening now, and I hope it does in some ways come out of just looking at enslavement, but looking at Reconstruction, looking at the whole history of America to now, and with the same intensity as this, because you never saw films like this before. At least I haven't in my time seeing films as intense as are coming out now. But I know when I watch Holocaust movies, I get like really tight, I get upset, I get angry, as I did when watching this, and make me think about things. So this is a very important genre of films coming out now, and TV that has never really hit before.
Yeah. So another way to think about what the work that it can do, and this is, and I'll go back against what I was against my earlier claim today, and also in the first episode. So one way to think about it. So what we thought would happen after Roots, given how successful it was, was that we'd see a wave of TV shows, dramas, et cetera, featuring predominantly black casts with black casts. And what we got were sitcoms, but we never really got the dramatic stuff. Or we got it, but it was canceled. So what we might be seeing now is that Roots is actually being made at the more appropriate time, and now with Roots we'll start to see, you know, more stuff, right? Whether it, now we know Nat Turner's coming, and that was a movie
right.
that I wouldn't have that I wouldn't you know I was I would. It was easier for me to believe that Obama would be president in 2004 when I pretty much called it than it would for me to imagine a real movie about Nat Turner ever being made. So it's possible that what this thing is doing culturally is creating the ground where we really do see people doing more exploration about this time. Because, I mean, if you think about it, from 1619 to 1865, that's, 266 years of stories. That's 266 years of stories that we really haven't explored, right? Whether it be slave rebellions, whether it be
right.
instances of interracial love, whether it be instances of betrayal, all those stories, development of the West, all those stories, we really haven't told those yet.
I think we're at a very critical moment. See what happens. Anybody want to jump in on that before we?
It's interesting because there were the comments by Snoop Dogg and several others that talked about, you know, not watching Roots or any other slave narrative that's been presented to us. And I get it. I understand why people are struggling with it because it is a re-traumatizing experience, right? If you've seen it or had access to such narratives before, then it makes you have to relive in a way that I think, Mark, what you're talking about, sitting there tight and fist clenched at the screening that I went to, there were people wailing at some of what they experience watching the interactions of what happens on the slave ship during the Middle Passage. And so individuals not wanting to have that experience again. But for me, again, I think the shift was, what disservice do we do to the younger generation if they don't have that historical context? Like, they are hearing it. Right. At some point in time, you're hearing it in a social studies class of, in American slavery. But in terms of giving it a context so that the younger generations can use that to catapult themselves instead of wallow in something that makes them feel like they mm-hmm. are already a demised people who don't have an opportunity to thrive. That would be the concern I have about not wanting to share these 266 year stories.
Yeah. Real quick, to be fair to Snoop, and I never thought I'd say this, to be fair to Snoop, that's a deeply American sentiment, right? So Americans don't want to know the bad part of their own history. Nobody, you know, so that's just Snoop being American, right? Which gets back to, you know, Alex Haley's point. This is an American family. It's just Snoop being American. I don't want no bad stuff. All I want is kings and queens and some more weed. You know what I mean?
Some of that fantasy goes together. That's a whole other program. We'll do it another day. And I will do it. Look him.
I'm really appreciating the comments of people who have seen the original series, because one thing that sort of held in tension for me with the new series is how there is a lot of violence. But also, I just, watching the newer series, I think that this sort of comes out through watching something rather than reading slave narratives, rather than reading reports, is this sort of complexity of enslaved people's position, right? And how sometimes Chicken George was like, this white man who has raped my mother has to live because if he dies, my whole family will be scattered. And so that complexity is humanizing, right? Because that's something that people have to deal with, is having to contend with someone who has more power with you, and how sometimes you end up sympathizing with them and you hate them, right, at the same time.
Yeah. I love that you're raising the complexity piece, because I do think the human complexity
right.
is very real in this episode. I mean, in this series, right? I mean, even to go back to Chicken George as a character,
right?
When we see him in that moment of being able to save himself and his son, right, from the bushwhackers,
right,
because he is able to shift gears and go back to a space of performing, right, amongst these white soldiers.
That was powerful.
It was beautiful. It was unreal.
I'm going to save my family right here, right now.
And this is how I will do it. Because I understand that this is what works in this particular context. I know who I am, and I know how I really am in my authentic self. But in this moment, to save my family, this is the shift that I'm willing to make. And that complexity was not given to us in previous slave narratives, or I would say even in the original roots, because we saw slaves as this very monolithic, very flat understanding of who these people were. But in this instance, we have a chance to see that level of depth and complexity that does exist.
And speaking of that, another piece I thought that was really subtle in here, and I haven't seen anybody really write about this yet, is the fluidity between house and field. Ever since Malcolm made that speech about house and field Negroes, remember?
People took it literally when it really meant metaphorically.
It was a binary, right?
And but when you look at the reality of who actually led a lot of the slave rebellions, they actually were people who got stuck in the house and then went back and forth. And B, when you read the slave narratives from the 19th century, you see that fluidity existed. That, I thought, was a very subtle but important piece of what they put in here for lots of reasons.
And there's also a fluidity in gender roles in this, right? Because at the beginning, Kunta Kinte is he's like being examined by that white man when he first comes to America, and he's sort of like that white man is touching him in intimate places, and that's sort of a role that you think of as a woman's place. But of course, that is happening to a black man, and you see it. It particularly came out for me with Kunta and his relationship with Kizzy, and how it's Kunta who sort of teaches Kizzy how to be a woman, but he teaches her how to be a woman in the way that a black woman had to be a woman while enslaved, right? And so he teaches her to be a warrior. He teaches her to be strong.
And when she jumps on the back of that horse.
That was amazing.
We see the manifestation of all that training, right?
Right.
That was a powerful moment, too.
So what do you think that, since we know that all of America is not seeing this, as they did with Roots?
Well, 14 versus but 30.
No, it's a lot. Yeah. And people will see it more because they'll be on DVD and they'll be, you know, seeing that they can watch it on demand and whatever else the people do in these days, and Hulu it and Netflix it once you get there, right? So it'll all be there for a while to come in ways we watch media today. But this to me, I think is, well, let me take it this way. What I mentioned earlier, what do you think of the is developing here with this new genre of film and TV, and what it says about where we're going in this century, and what has to happen, especially if it can continue?
Yeah. So there's a book, I just got it yesterday. Amazon Prime is dope. It's about Albert Murray.
I got that book.
Of interviews. Albert Murray was a contemporary of Ralph Ellison. Served in the military, was incredibly productive after retirement, wrote from 45 to 97. And one of the things, you know, age 45 to age 97, one of the things that he would consistently articulate is that American culture is at base a Negro culture, right? He was kind of he was a Negro nationalist, and he was writing against white racists on the other hand, but he was also writing against black power folk on the other, who thought that the only way to retain kind of a blackness was to go outside of the continent and ignore most of the stuff, particularly slavery, right? So one of the things I think we're seeing now, particularly given the demographic shifts, are stories that really are stories that are working to create in film what we already had in music, this kind of what Albert Murray called an omni-American impulse. Right. I think that's a good thing. I think that's where we're going. Assuming it continues, because, again, we thought it would happen. You know, we thought it would happen with the first series. It didn't quite happen. Assuming it continues, that's what I think we're moving.
I don't know, Kimberly, but as we round this up, my thinking at the moment, in my positive end of my thinking, is that those things are happening now, that we're moving and shifting in ways. We're always shifting in this society. From the beginning, from 1619 to now, we've been shifting, never stopped shifting, never stopped moving. And the resistance has never stopped happening as well, against the shifting and moving of the resistance. So, I mean, but I really do feel like we're in a place now that these things can begin to happen and begin to kind of deepen and heighten the contradictions and deepen and heighten the conversations.
So I'm sounding a bit more cynical because I do have the encouragement to believe that this can be another one of those shifts that we're talking about, right? But I also then find myself bombarded with what my students are watching and what they have access to in terms of media, and wonder, does that, in particular when I'm thinking reality television genre, does that give us a foundation for some of the major shifts that we're talking about that can occur? And at least on the surface level, I would say absolutely not, because it's not doing any shifting in the more positive way. But I am hopeful that we will see some of those shifts that make a difference when we think about, you know, things such as the Nat Turner insurrection being told like never before, right?
I can't wait to see it cinematically
on screen.
Yeah,
that is powerful. That is powerful to have as a story retold, especially in our contemporary society. But at the same time, you got that going on, and you also got Real Housewives of Atlanta. And so when you think about that is America, that is that complexity of what it means to be American. But at the same time, when it carries so much weight in terms of how we see ourselves as American, does that then also give us a foundation for being able to go to the next level and catapult?
So, Lakima, you have the closing thought here.
Oh, no pressure. I mean, I think I see the series as sort of changing the way that people interpret having been enslaved, because I find that, and I don't know if this is just a generational thing, but sometimes people see being descended from slaves as an abject position, and that makes people identify more as African as opposed to African American. And so I think that seeing series like this that sort of display the complexity and humanity of enslaved people gives people a sort of pride at having been descended from these people who, no matter what, resisted and were resilient and kept their culture in whatever way they could, or even just survived, right? Because that is a triumph, to survive that. And so I think that if Roots does that, then it achieves something, right?
But this has been an incredibly intense and wonderful conversation, and I hope we can continue this over the coming months and what this inspires. It inspired me a lot just hearing the three of you and what you all had to say. You just heard Lakima Pennyman, rising senior at Morgan State University, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Care Body Politics in Africana Communities, Dr. Lester Spence, associate professor of political science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book, Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn of Black Politics. Thank the three of you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Amani Spence. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA. 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.